CliffCentral.com. Today, Justice Malala looks like he's actually just, something's hit him.
Mm.
So let's get right into this. Burning Platform with Justice Malala.
Burning Platform, fired up by Nando's on CliffCentral.com.
So Justice, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, we were just saying, you're throwing in the towel, you've had enough. What's going on here? Yeah. You in a depression?
I'm feeling a bit low. You know, the news cycle can be tiring, actually.
Yeah.
Because we get it.
Completely.
If you think about it, this country, just on Monday, you had court cases, you had, Shona Prams is going for this, no doubt. Nomcobo Jiva is home free, and then it's Tuesday, then it's Wednesday, and then today there'll be more, and then on Friday there'll be more, then the Sunday papers will have even more.
Whew, it's almost as if we don't get a break.
I think I need a holiday.
We were talking to Gareth earlier this morning, and he was asking for a quick rundown of what's been happening in the country, and I said, well, you definitely need to listen to Justice when he comes in, because you know, in the news, we saw all these images, Justice, on television. We saw them on social media of, you know, what looks like a war zone in Hammanskraal.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, take us right back to the beginning. How did all of this start? What stage are we at now? And how is this going to end?
Well, how is this going to end? Mabali, you know, I was particularly drawn to the Hammanskraal story because I'm from there. Every time I come on the show and I talk about, my mother in Hammanskraal. But Hammanskraal is actually quite a big series of villages. And for me, the events this week illustrate so much that we should all be careful about with the August 3rd elections coming up. First of all, those thousands of people who've set up their homes, their informal settlements, on that piece of land. By the way, it's just like 8 minutes from my mother's house, this village. It's the village 3 villages away. It's very close. It's a small, poor, semi-rural area. People are desperate, and that people are desperate enough to move into a barren piece of land without services, without anything, just shows you just how desperate people are. But what happened there is that all those people were adamant that we were given this piece of land. By who? By the local councillor. And they were saying the local councillor gave us this piece of land. We paid some money. Some say 400 rand, some say 2,000 rand, whatever the amount is. But someone gave permission for those people. Someone in authority gave permission for those people to move in there and live there and set up houses and stands and so forth there. The question for me is, where was this person throughout this week as Hammanskraal burned?
Yeah.
Where was this person when Paul Mashatile, the MEC in Gauteng, went there and said, we're going to broker a deal? Why didn't anyone stop and say, who caused this whole thing? Because the Kekana chieftaincy, the Kekana royal family, as some refer to them, keep on saying, this is our land. Apparently, they got the court order to get those informal settlers removed. Now, when they first got the court order to remove these guys, people were given notices. Those guys say they weren't given notices. But we have a clear issue of law that this is Mabale Moloi's piece of land. Someone comes and squats on it. You get a court order. Now, the law works in a convoluted way. So it takes you 2 months, 3 months, 5 months to get the court order to get these people evicted. And when it finally happens, who allowed that person to come on them? There is something that's not being said about what happened in Hammanskraal. It's who is the local councillor who said to those people, you can move there because whatever. And so the rule of law, if it was applied correctly, someone should be in jail tonight. And that person is the councillor who allowed those people, who in fact didn't allow, said the Tshwane Council has approved this piece of land for habitation, and we're going to put in services, and if you give me 400 or 2,000 or whatever, it's going to happen. I haven't seen anyone talk about the rule of law, because the rule of law would have said, you know what, you can't lie to people like that. You can't do that. So as a first, as a beginning, residents who are protesting, who gave you this piece of land? Then let's arrest you, put you in jail. Then let's solve the problem.
Are these residents not able to name this councillor?
Well, I haven't seen this councillor named. Excuse me. If you go just 10 minutes down the road to my mother's village, I can tell you who my mother's councillor is. It happens to be someone I grew up with who's been one of my best friends since I was a kid. So I can say, you know what, Joseph Mohale, you guy, you did this, if it was him. But it's not him, because it's another village, it's a different ward. So I would like to know where the ward councillor for that area is. And so this brings me to something that Julius Malema said yesterday. Julius Malema said, why do you keep on voting for the same people if they do these things to you?
Mm.
You know, in that village, the ANC wins by upwards of 90%.
Mm.
In my mother's village, the ANC wins by upwards of 90%. Well, it's about 85%. In fact, 88%. Every election, if it's below 90%, the ANC in the village starts moaning. Oh, what have we done? Something is wrong. 90%. So those people who now have a councillor who said, settle on this piece of land. What I find interesting, and what I will find interesting, will be to go and see on August 3rd how they vote, who they vote for. I suspect that councillor may be returned. That could happen. And so I'm not sure about what is the meaning of moving forward and moving backward. What messages are going to be sent by this? So there's several things about Hammanskraal for me. It's one, the rule of law. Someone should be going to jail for having broken the law and given out parcels of land that they didn't own, that the council doesn't own, out to people. That's a first for me. Secondly, Paul Mashatile can't go there and say, oh, you know, the court ruled that these people must be removed, and I am the MEC. I'm going to arrive and I'm going to say, no, let's talk about it. You stay on this piece of land. So who, the private owner of that land, what recourse do they have when a politician comes along and says, no, I say. You guys do this. Where was the politician over the past 5 months when this problem was boiling and boiling and boiling and boiling? They weren't there. And so I think it's problematic for politicians to be taking over what is essentially a matter of law. I'm not saying actually that we should just kick out the indigent and so forth. But I think when it comes to a point of law, politicians need to be careful that it's no longer just, oh, you know, Mabala came and set up a shack on my piece of land. And so I'm going to follow what Mabala does. Mabala should have followed some rules and regulations and got a piece of land too. I just think there is let's forget about the law now. The guys are here. And so, you know, let's just settle down.
So, Justice, in the middle of all of this, while the politicians are still, you know, backing and forthing with each other, and, you know, when the law steps in, dishing out court orders and eviction notices and all sorts of things, what happens to the people who were actually evicted? What happens to them?
According to the task team and the sort of agreement put together yesterday, they're basically back on those pieces of land.
Okay.
And they will stay there. This, I interviewed Housing Minister, Human Settlements Minister, Lindiwe Sisulu. One of the problems I have with the way we build houses in South Africa is that first, Ben goes and puts up a shack. And then we say it's on the banks of the Yaxke River. We know winter, summer's coming. It's going to rain.
Mm.
And it's going to get flooded.
Mm.
And then that shack gets flooded, and your kids drown or whatever. Or there's a fire because the shacks are too close to each other. But instead of saying, we're going to enforce the law, and make sure that Ben actually moves to a nicer place, a place with services in Alexandria, and we build those. We must build those. We come to Ben's shack on the banks of the Yaxke and say, oh, we'll get you electricity and so forth. So we follow, laws get broken and proper rules and regulations get broken. Instead of saying, no, here's an alternative, you have to move to the alternative. We say, no, I'll bring you electricity on the banks of the Yaxke. What is going to happen? Without a shadow of doubt, there will be the rains will come in November and it will get flooded. So what's happening in Hammanskraal is on a bigger scale exactly the same thing. People have settled the land and now we're going and saying, oh, you know, we don't say the person who you say gave you this piece of land was absolutely outrageous and they're going to jail. Two, you guys, this is private land. If the private landowner says, no, you cannot settle here, we will find you a serviced piece of land owned by government and you will move there. But what are we saying? We're saying, oh, no, you stay. We'll find a solution. So we're going to go. We're going to put in services. It's going to be all okay and so forth. And what does the person in Zandspruit say? Says, oh, those guys burnt tires and blocked roads and so forth and so forth. I'm going to do it too because they got what they wanted and someone else does it. And what do you have? I always quote this number, 14,700. Remember it. That's the number of unrest incidents reported to the police in the year to March last year. Why? We're becoming a society that knows that if I start burning up this studio, Mabale and Ben and Gareth and everyone else will listen to me. It can't be that way. It's got to be a point where it says, you know what, Justice, if you want something, you make your case, you don't go to work or you withdraw your labor, whatever it is, and then you'll get a result. Not you burn up the whole thing. And that's what's happening basically in Hammanskraal. I'm sorry to say I am from there and I have huge sympathy with many of the protesters and what they stand for. I think it's totally, absolutely terrible to right in the middle of winter to go and evict people and so forth and so forth. But also I have to weigh against the rule of law and other issues. And I think that's where sometimes we miss the point. What's going to happen today? There is another community which is going to be doing exactly what happened in Hammanskraal. And what are we going to do? We're going to go and say, it's okay, you've done enough of this. We will do exactly as you wish and as you want.
It's a very dangerous domino effect here, but it's like you say, if it's been working here, it'll work somewhere else.
It will. And I have to say, we have just a few months to go to August 3. And what's going to happen is that communities, you're going to see more and more protests of this nature every day until August 3 because people believe they have leverage. The ANC will run in, as Paul Mashatile did, and say, I'll set up a task team, I'll listen to you, and so forth and so forth. Because Paul Mashatile wants the ANC to get 90% in those villages in Hammanskraal, and so he makes a political deal. But is a political deal always the right deal? No, it's not, because the problem will be here on August 4, and he won't be running there because he'll have got the vote. What happens then? What's the lasting solution to the problem in Hammanskraal?
Yeah, it's true. It's all superficial stuff. It's like election, yeah, let's get this done.
Yeah, yeah.
Tick the boxes that we move on.
Yeah. But the problem is not going to go away on August 3. And that, for me, is where real solutions to real problems are needed.
Yeah. Well, speaking longer term, what's happening with Tweema Ntsele and successor in that one?
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to put this out to all our listeners everywhere that the process has started. A committee has been named to find a new public protector and recommend to the president. I just want to say,
I love the first part of that sentence. The second part got me worried.
Let's not forget that Tweema Ntsele was appointed by President Zuma.
Yeah.
I think it's about the process. How many people say, you say Tulima Dansela and people just melt and are so happy. If you look at the interviews you guys have done here, I think the Tulima Dansela interview is one of the top interviews you've ever done. And it's one of those, as an institution, it is the institution in South Africa. It makes you proud to be South African. You can go anywhere in the world and say, we've got Tulima Dansela, so we, okay. Now, a lot of people are, you know, just depressed that she's leaving in October. So, oh, it's the end of the world. What's going to happen without Tuli? People can influence that. People can influence who comes after her.
How?
You need to join up, for example, with an organization like Corruption Watch, which is saying it's not about Tuli leaving. It's about who replaces her.
Mm.
So let us get the voice of the of ordinary South Africans into influencing those people. So nominating new people. If you think, oh, you know, Deputy Chief, former Deputy Chief Justice Dikgang Motsenekga should be the guy, then lobby. Work with people like Corruption Watch and say, we will going to put up a petition for those 11 MPs to get that name and to interview this person and tell us why, or why they didn't choose him, or why they are choosing him. You don't want the situation where I remember once people were being nominated for the SABC board and the names were being faxed from Esop Pahad, who was the minister in President Mbeki's office. Names were being faxed from his office by one of his minions. And it was supposed to be an open process from the general community, and it wasn't. So this time, South Africans have to show that they're actually active citizens. So, you know, ban for public protector, then you and I have to start writing in, sending in his CV, saying this is why he should be the person, and making sure that those MPs actually do a job that is above board, that will give us a public protector who will continue the traditions and values that this public protector has embedded in that office.
Would you see there's any sort of outstanding potential here? Is there any people that have been put forward already?
A lot of people are talking about Vusi Pikoli. They're saying Vusi Pikoli has been absolutely amazing as the police ombudsman in the Western Cape. He stood up for the rule of law when he was the head of the NPA. That he is not someone who, you know, who takes orders from above. He has proven himself to be an independent person by all accounts. So that's a name that's been heavily bandied about. People have been feeling very sad about the departure of Dikgang Motsenekga from the Constitutional Court, and they're saying he must go. He must be nominated. I don't know if he's got the appetite for that. After being a Chief Justice, I'm also not sure about the rules that govern what one can do after being a judge. So I'm not quite sure. So those are two names that have been put about. There have been some other names, but not as prominent.
Just out of interest, do we know what kind of job spec is required to fill the position of public protector in this country?
There is a job spec, yeah. Actually. I haven't looked at it closely, but there is a job spec that's pretty general. So it could leave you with a dance, and it could leave you with a spectacular person. So I think one of the things that Corruption Watch has underlined is, let's get people with a track record of independence, of respect for the law, of a track record of being able to respect the law but not be intimidated by politicians, whoever they might be. Someone who's not party political, someone who won't end up being a lackey of some or other political party or politician. And I think that's the key thing. But there is a job spec somewhere.
Well, I think that's an important message to get across, Justice, because you know, as South Africans, we love to moan. It's our favorite pastime, and we're very good at that. But when it comes to being active citizens, and here's an opportunity for us to get involved and to influence who the next public protector is.
It's a committee of 11 that's going to make the selection. It's 6 ANC MPs. It's 2 DA. It's 1 EFF, I think. It's 2 other parties sort of club together and they nominate 2. So those 11 are the ones that people need to start identifying and saying, okay, you 11 are going to give us and must give us someone who is as good as Tulima Donsela or better.
Or better, yeah. All right. Well, Justice, you do have to go shortly, but I did think that it was important for us to get you to comment on the president's wives and the allegation that up to 9 million rand was spent buying, you know, vehicles for the spouses. You know, the opposition party would have loved this because it gave them another opportunity to, you know, to do their job. What's your take on all of this?
I just want to say, first of all, guys, you know, in 2007, when the ANC elected Jacob Zuma in December, on December 18, I think it was, in Polokwane, they knew exactly who Jacob Zuma was. There was no, you know, they knew his personal circumstances, the things he had done, his weaknesses, and so forth. So, in a way, I respect the ANC. What's the song? You guys know these country songs.
No.
Stand by your man.
I think that was actually on CS request list for today.
So there you go. So, you know, the ANC has stood by its men with all the issues, problems, whatever that he's come with. South Africans, I want to say, South Africans, you're all listening. In 2009, in May, you elected Jacob Zuma, and you knew that he has so many wives. He is this, he is that, he is that. So today when I hear people saying, oh, but how can you spend 9 million rand on his wives? You could have sent, so how many kids?
I don't
116
know.
Kids.
160, I think. Something like, how many kids could we have sent to university? Fees must fall. And I say to you, stand by your man. Because you knew. We all knew. 2014. We all knew. Again, we didn't vote for him once. We voted for him twice.
So you're saying we're getting exactly what we deserve?
We're getting exactly what we knew. We knew. This is not... for me, I see the story and I see the question that the DAMP put to the president and the answer that got to Natin Tlhako, and I see the answer coming and I say, man... stand by your man because you voted for him in 2014. No, but seriously, I'm not surprised by the answer to the question that and I'm sure the DA knew the answer before they asked the question. And that's the key thing here. You ask the question that it's what lawyers do all the time. You ask the question that you have the answer to, not the one that you don't have, because that might throw you out a bit. So they asked the question that they knew the answer. They got the answer and then they start weeping that, oh. And I say, stand by your man. So I'm not surprised by Jacob Zuma's 9 million rand. I think it's amazing that, I picked this up somewhere, that the family, the spouses, did receive cars in 2013. And these cars that the police ministry seems to have acquired are new. So, you know, I'm starting to think maybe all South Africans should start changing their cars every couple of years.
I'd be happy to do that if the economy allowed me to, Justice.
It's a good idea.
Thank you.
And bigger cars too.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Why must I drive my little Skaftiniana of a car?
You know, I mean, as the elections loom closer, I find it particularly fascinating that the ANC doesn't seem to think that these things will matter to the people who did vote for it in 2014-2009. I think the ANC is going to get a clap for all these kinds of things emanating from the president's office. No matter what happens, the thing is, these things matter, and they keep on piling up and piling up around President Zuma. And so that is why President Zuma today, his personal approval rating among South Africans is in the low 20s. South Africans just find the whole, all the shenanigans around the president just sad and embarrassing. So, you know, Julius Malema was in Mpumalanga yesterday banging on about Jacob Zuma is the blesser in chief, and he's using taxpayers' money to bless his wives.
You're going to hand this to Julius, he's quite contemporary with his politics.
He's out there. He's really out there. So, you know, and do you blame him? You can't blame him, because he's using exactly the weaknesses that Jacob Zuma has. Should the spouses of the president be protected? Yes. Should they be receive cars and so forth? Yes. But it was interesting for me that David Cameron's wife received a car on the same day.
Yeah.
And it was a second-hand car. but he negotiated the price down as much as he could.
Yeah, it's quite funny. When Jay-Z wants a car, he'll tell Cabinet. When David Cameron wants a car, he goes Auto Trader. Exactly. He gets online. He starts reading reviews.
So, you know, I mean, the comparisons aren't always perfect, but when you live in this country and you drive to the studio as we do, and every street corner in Sandton has some child, whatever their circumstances, begging for money for food, and you have on the other hand this sort of let them eat cake attitude, it shows an incredible sense, lack of awareness of who we are and what we are, and where we, how our minds, our consciousness should situate itself. So, you know, I mean, I laugh at the cars and all that, but that sense that, you know, we are, that those in power are now royalty rather than elected representatives, is underlined by this sort of expenditure. It's underlined by the Minister of Defense going in a plane belonging to the Defense Force, Defense Ministry, to Burundi or to the DRC and picking up someone who is friends with her kids and bringing them into the country without documentation. It's a sense of, what are you people saying? Just shut up, because we are kings and queens, not elected representatives. That is just, it's, if you believe in holding people to account, just these two incidents show you that there is a huge sense among some of our politicians that actually we are untouchable, and because we are in power, we are royalty, not servants of the people. And I think that is deeply, hugely problematic.
Yeah, that title public servant seems to have fallen away quite a lot. Eh?
And that is a big, for me, that is a matter of massive, it's a big problem.
All right, Justice, well, I think that's all we've got time for today. There's always like a bit of a theme to the messages we get about you. Today, I'm going to address the one of politics. Graham says, always great listening to you, Justice, politically. Are you available politically? Graham wants to know.
This is not the first time this question has been asked.
I've been scared of it. Jocelyn says exactly the same thing. I would vote for this incredible gentleman, no matter his party. He makes so much sense, speaks so much truth. Justice, is that in your future?
No, absolutely not. No, but thank you, but no.
Okay, see, you ask him that, he becomes Bladen Zamandi in a second.
No!
All right, Justice, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Gareth will be here next Thursday.
Yeah, it'll be. I think the ship's running fine, perfectly without him. Let's just let the Americans take him.
In fact, let's just lock all the doors so he can't come back in once he's back in the country.
We've been spreading rumors how he's gone, and we changed the name. So when he comes back, it'll be a very different sign.
Mabale Central.
Yeah. Well, at the moment, that's the most popular. Cool, Justice. Catch you next weekend.
Guys. Bye.
Thank you, Justice.
Burning Platform, fired up by Nando's on cliffcentral.com.
Well, that gets us to halfway through. Michael, the 7 hour, huh? Or does it only work with the 8 hour?
It only works with the 8 hour. This is the 7 to 8 hour.
Okay, well, what's the interview got coming up later?
Gareth caught up with the Johannesburg Youth Orchestra. And it's such a cool interview because he gets them to play their instruments. They explain it. And there's a guy in the interview. He plays so many instruments. It's ridiculous. Like, I am dumbfounded when I see a guy who can play, like, a flute, a piano, a clarinet, a this, a that. A piano.
Yeah, and what can you play, Flex?
I can't even blow my nose right.
Okay, just chatting on the line. Mubs, can you give us a very brief rundown of what we've got to look forward to after the show today? Because I know it's Thursday, and Thursday's quite a spicy day.
Thursday, after the Johannesburg Youth Orchestra interview at 9 o'clock, will be the open book with Loyiso Bala. And remember, Gareth was telling us that the open book has been... Well, I can't remember now. It's been nominated for what?
I think it's... hang on a second. I think Sia might know more about this.
Yeah. Okay, so...
Is... The Trump... I'm trying to also get the exact term here.
All right, well, while you're trying to do that, let me let you know what...
The Trumpet Africa Gospel Music Awards. There we go. That's it's a bit of a mouthful.
All right, so that is exciting stuff. Can we vote for Loyiso?
Yes. Okay. So the best and quickest way to do it is just to go to cliffcentral.com. Under Connect, there's exclusive. There's a whole brief background on the awards. And then there's a link straight to vote.
All right, fantastic. So, one-on-one today with Mahalia Buchanan. Loyiso chats to the gifted gospel singer and worship leader. Then, after all that sainthood and just goodness and, you know, good-spiritedness, in comes the gang from The Unview.
All right.
Somisu Mhlonga and Alan Ford. And today, it's all about theater with a look at Born to Perform with Brian Schimmel, a Michael Jackson tribute from London, The Full Morty, and more.
The full Morty,
not the full Monty this time. That,
if Alan's involved, I'm out of here.
11 to 12 is a weekly mashup with Dumisho Masha and Candice Mama. You can join Dumisho and Candice as they tackle body shaming in society and the Lerato Kanyaho True Love magazine drama.
Yes, I was about to say, there's been a lot around that on the back of that magazine.
Yeah, so a lot of people complained that the magazine had done too much Photoshop on her, and then in their defense, the magazine decided to release a whole series of before and after pictures to try and explain why they did the body shop. Then, you know, then they were accused of body shaming. It's a whole big mess. So Dumisho and Candice will be tackling that issue today. Then from 12 to 1 is Unplugged and In Charge. That's with Simpiwe, Lisejo, and Weza, that guy, and Vaughn Thiel. With Youth Month approaching, yes, June 16 and the whole of June, Youth Month. Keti Ngwenya, founder of School Media, joins the team to talk about generational change by connecting brands to communities one school at a time. Then from 1 to 2 is Fashion Lab with...
1 to do?
1 to 2. What did I say?
One to do.
The show is one to do as well.
No, do you know that I don't hear myself when I make these mistakes?
It's okay. We only ridicule you on the bad ones. So carry on.
So from 1 to 2 is the Fashion Lab. And today they're dissecting the business behind fashion to provide a platform for growth and development within the fashion industry. 2 to 3, future CEOs with Gareth Armstrong and Klubin Boya. McLean Sibanda, CEO of the Innovation Hub, shares his wisdom and insights after leading in business and industry for many years. Then Bradley Elliott, who is MD of digital company Platinum Seed, shares some insight and lessons learned whilst growing his business. Then 3 o'clock is The Queue with Mark Bland. Imagine if Howard Stern took over The Daily Show, as in Howard Stern replacing Trevor Noah. Well, that's the vibe of The Queue today.
Look, I mean, Howard's great and all, but for TV... Why? Maybe not anymore.
No, I mean, yeah.
I mean, he looks like a South Park character. He's funny as all hell, but he just looks... Maybe not TV.
You are absolutely right. But you know what? Mark Bland on the Q's, I suspect he might have a problem with Trevor Noah. Like, he doesn't really like him that much. But you'll have to wait for 3 o'clock to find out, or any time after that, really, if you download any of our podcasts. Then from 4 to 6, Kelman on Cliff Central. And today, Marv Lou holds down the fort in Blogger Diaries. CEO of Music Channel Trace, Olivier.
Ooh. I think that's Mary Lou with a typo.
Mary Lou. Oh, okay, my bad.
That really isn't your fault.
I'm waiting for the surname there.
I can't say the surname.
I probably can't even. Yeah.
It's a French surname, guys. Olivier Lauchez. I don't know. Goodness, I feel terrible for not knowing how to pronounce that. But Askis. So that is.
I butcher so many names.
That
so
is the CEO of Trace. The music channel. So he'll be joining Aria today.
And now you got to listen to work out what his name really sounds like.
Yes. And then from 6 to 7 is the maid sessions. Domestic workers are simultaneously the most ubiquitous and invisible among us. Be a fly on the wall as we gain their unique perspectives on a range of matters. That's the 6 o'clock podcast.
Yeah, as you can see, we've got the live and we've got so many shows now. We've got so much talent here on Cliff Central. We actually have to go into the 6 to 7 PM slot as well.
Yeah.
And the way this channel is growing, it could be even further than that. But speaking of growing, the show needs to go into the next stage, and that is, of course... Mabali's News! All right, Mubs. What's happening?
Well, what's happening is that SARS are preparing themselves for what might be a lengthy and busy session on their part, because they have now revealed that they will be investigating 1,700,000. Oh! I did a president move.
137,100.
I don't know what was worse, the fact that she did that or the fact that she caught herself.
1,700 South Africans. My God!
1,700.
Okay, 1,700. Okay.
Never gonna be able to live this down.
Just 1,700.
I don't know what my problem is.
That made my day.
1,700 South Africans are about to be investigated by SARS. Now, these are the South Africans who were named in those Panama Papers. The plot thickens. SARS has identified the names of the 1,700 individual South African residents in the data released in the Panama Papers, and they range from shareholders and directors to beneficiaries. In addition, 56 South African intermediaries have been identified. This is all according to the SARS Group Executive for Product Oversight, the Legal and Policy. That's Flock Symington. Now, SARS are busy matching the identities of these individuals with the SARS database. They're also testing the Panama data against the income tax declarations of the South African residents. So far, 79 of a total 560 offshore entities have been matched to 81 South African residents. And Symington said that it's too early to predict the level of tax avoidance or evasion that these people are accused of, and that the process of profiling and enforcement are going to be lengthy by nature.
Mm-hmm.
But how's that?
Yes, always lengthy by nature.
Yeah. So a whole bunch of shareholders and directors to beneficiaries are sitting there today, and they're kind of breaking a sweat, and they're thinking, damn it, is my name on this list of 1,700 people who are now accused of tax avoidance or evasion? Have I just been caught? Is what these people are sitting there thinking.
That's a lot, huh?
Yes!
1,700 people.
Sure.
This is like our own Panama Papers, suddenly.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just waiting for SARS to also get into the Mandela family. Did you guys hear about that?
Oh, no.
Tell me.
So it is, you know, the first portion of Nelson Mandela's assets, worth millions really, are ready for distribution actually tomorrow, which is Friday, as per Nelson Mandela's will, which is really his whole multi-million rand estate. So as it stands, 34 million rands is being distributed tomorrow amongst his family and everyone actually put in his will. And so the executives we know, Advocate George Bezos, amongst others, and just casually, you know, his grandchildren are all just getting the likes of 3.1 million rands for Mandla Mandela, another 3.1 million for Ndaba Mandela. Some of his grandchildren and great-grandchildren are each getting 100,000 rands each. Graca Machel's children also aren't being left out. Both of them are getting 3.1 million as well. And so it's currently unclear what is actually happening to Kunu, which I was very surprised to find out is worth 7.2 million rand. Wow. And is 96.8 hectares. This is actually crazy. But I feel like to a certain extent, there are some things I feel like shouldn't have been exposed, or like we don't need to know about the Mandela family. But as facts and figures go, Mandela actually had a lot of property worth at like huge, huge prices. So for example, Nelson Mandela and Graca were married in community and property back in 1998. And so they both own a house in Mozambique, which is valued at 58 million rands. Yes.
Wowzers.
That's a high value.
I'm like, why?
It's incredible.
Okay, firstly, I'm not trying to incite any sort of World War III in the Mandela family, but you guys are busy fighting over Kunu.
For 7 million?
Are you saying that they should
move? And there's a house in Mozambique?
Are you saying that they should restructure their fight, Sia?
If I was one of the grandchildren, I'd be like, okay, cool, why are they preoccupied here? They move over to Mozambique and fight.
Because you know, for that much money, anywhere in the world's a palace. And wow. Mozambique, that's going to be like a hyper palace.
58 million rands
in Maputo in Mozambique. There's also property worth 3.8 million rands in Gaza. I'm just like,
Gaza?
Of all places?
You see, I feel like these properties were given as a gift, sort of.
Well, you would think with Gaza, yeah, because that's not really on the hot...
an investment.
That's
spot.
Not a buying list there.
Well, it's still going to go to someone. So the documents put...
And it's still worth something.
Absolutely. The documents put the total property or share at about 60.9 million rands. Sure. So, you know, it's a huge payday going out to the family, the Mandela family come tomorrow.
And, you know, I mean, how long has it been now since Nelson Mandela passed? Because
2 years now.
Is it 2 years?
Yeah.
So that's how long it's taken for this process to be rectified. And now only the payments are going to come. You know, it just goes to show you how long these things take.
But there's all this procedure and this protocol that still has to happen. For example, there's going to be a 21-day, I don't know, window period, may I even call it that, where, you know, people are welcome to come in and question where the money's going, or they contact the executive to see.
What do you mean by people? The family?
I think it is credible people. Like old C.S. Ungrenifin can't just knock on George Bezos' door and start to question.
It's none of our business, really.
Yeah, but I think the family or people listed in the will are allowed to actually go and see that the money is actually directed to the right people and going to the right places. But yeah. 34 million rands, and this is only just phase one of the will. So, yeah.
Okay, then.
Fun times for the Mandelas, let's just put it that
way. Wow, yeah, that's so interesting.
All right, well, less fun times for the Obama administration, because they are being sued over the transgender bathroom access situation. Texas are being joined by 10 other states in the United States of America to sue the Obama administration. This is because the administration told schools and colleges to allow transgender students to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity to comply with existing civil rights laws. Now, this has been a hot topic over the last few weeks. The lawsuit was announced yesterday afternoon. Texas is joined by Alabama, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Tennessee, Arizona, Maine, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Utah, and Georgia in the suit. This is basically what President Obama said on this matter. He said, "It is part of our obligation as a society to make sure everybody is treated fairly." Education Secretary John King Jr. had this to say: "No student should ever have to go through the experience of feeling unwelcome at school or on a college campus." But, you know, the Republicans are not about people being treated fairly. They disagree entirely with this move, saying that the Obama administration has conspired to turn workplaces and educational settings across the country into laboratories for a massive social experiment. Mm. And now the administration are being taken to task in this lawsuit.
Social experiment. Well, so much can come on the back of that.
Yeah,
would it be insensitive to just say, why don't people just hold it in and use the toilet at home?
Well, yeah.
That would
look, I mean, if you're on
alleviate all of our problems right now.
If you're on a college campus or if you're in school,
I think this.
You've got how many hours to hold it in before you get home?
You guys just, okay, go to the side of the road. But I don't understand how now, you know, the likes of some artists in Hollywood are now being criticized over touring in those places. So they must show solidarity. And some people have changed their tours or have canceled performances in certain cities. Even like Oprah was criticized for attending a graduation in one of those states. I mean, like,
so yeah, but that's all fans are capable of, is either praising or criticizing the people that they worship. As fans, we can do no more than that, really. Either we bitch and moan or we praise them.
But I am not, you know, Nick Jonas is one of those people who says he's cancelled his performances. A, do we really think of Nick Jonas as this great political commentator who's making, you know, great waves around the world and changing people's lives? And secondly, what is one concert going to change or, you know, hinder in the process of progress? I just think
absolutely nothing. It's going to have zero effect.
Hold it in, pee at home.
I know. Do you know how bad it is for your bladder to hold in pee?
Yeah, just holding in toilet is not a good idea.
You're still young, you'll recover.
I think this gives universities like an opportunity to possibly look at redesigning bathrooms. Like, instead of having a male and a female, you're paying for two bathrooms, make one bathroom unisex, but design it in a way that no one feels like it's intrusive or anything like that. Like, you can't see who's going in, you can't see who's going out. It's soundproof. Each has their own cubicle. Everyone can wash their hands together, though.
Yes, but this is the problem with trying to please everybody, human being, Flex, is that human beings, you can't please all of us. It's an impossibility.
Yeah.
So you could come up with the idea of having a unisex bathroom and then, you know, redesign the male-female signs, but there'll still be people bitching and moaning.
We need to learn to compromise.
We do, but
in certain situations,
you know,
it's just unnecessary.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
All right, guys. It is a Thursday, which means, you know, Pusa Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And so a San Francisco-based company has won a U.S. government-sponsored competition for their alcohol monitoring device that can be worn on the wrist, and then it basically monitors your level of alcohol. How cool is that? This is the latest milestone in the development of wearable technologies that monitor and diagnose medical conditions. The designers of this device took a $200,000 top prize in the National Institutes of Health Wearable Biosensor Challenge. The product has not yet been submitted to the Food and Drug Administration for marketing approval. They say that it can help doctors accurately measure a patient's drinking history and not just depend on the most recent tests. Medical, law enforcement, and transportation officials have long sought better technology for detection of blood alcohol levels. You know, when you get pulled over, you need to do a breathalyzer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is exactly what these types of devices are trying to replace. Traditional portable breath alcohol testers are unwieldy and can cost over R1,000, and they don't provide ongoing monitoring of alcohol levels. The blood alcohol monitoring device, however, used in legal and medical circles, are big and bulky, like a ball and chain for the ones using it, and they wanted to make something people would want to wear. So it's just a wearable alcohol monitoring device, essentially.
This is genius. Imagine like going to the club on a Saturday night and you driving, so you drink as much as the watch tells you can, and then you drive home. Like, you don't have to stress that you're over or you think you can have one more, but you really can't. This watch will tell you you can't have or you can have.
Yeah, so, but it's like, we all know that we can't drink much at all before we're over the limit. It's not like it's like, well, I can binge it till 10 and then I'll be all right because this thing's going to tell me.
No, but sometimes when you're tipsy, you don't think straight and you think, oh, maybe one more and I won't be over the limit, I'm fine. When in fact, you're actually drunk.
No, I disagree. I don't think anyone could be that naive. You know, two drinks makes you over the limit.
For you.
No, but I mean, like, Michael, there's a genuine, unless you're eating a lot or you of a huge structure or something, I mean, there's some, your average, you kind of know.
No, everyone's different. Like, the amount of shots it takes you to get drunk is different to the amount of shots it takes me to get drunk.
Drunk isn't the issue here. Alcohol tolerance isn't the issue. The law is the issue here. The law doesn't give a toss if how you party. The law is pretty concise in that this is a level that you should be operating on.
Yeah, but I still feel like people are naive to what is over the limit. Like, is it one beer, two beers, three beers, four beers?
Yeah, but when you're four beers in, you no longer care at what the legal limit is because...
Yeah, because then your inhibition's coming into this logical
thinking. Because
your
thought process has been compromised and now you're starting to make poor decisions. And that's why you end up either blacking out or with a massive headache as part of your hangover the morning after. Is because after a certain amount of alcohol, you start making poor decisions. That's just the way it works.
Yeah, sure. like telling the cop you're okay.
Yeah.
That's your first poor decision.
Now, did you know that it takes about 45 minutes for ethanol to be transmitted through your skin? All right.
What?
And this is exactly how this device works. Is it will be detecting that your alcohol level through your skin. Because usually, you know, you have to submit blood or whatever.
Yeah.
Or you blow into the breathalyzer.
Yeah.
So this device works completely on your skin. And the device is designed to provide a recent history of alcohol use as well. So if you have a bit of a drinking problem, this device will know. It will pick it up.
That's brilliant. Like, Jared makes a good point here on WeChat, is that people are just going to use it as a drinking game. Let's see who can get trashed the quickest. When breathalyzers first came to bars in Bloom, what they used to do was they'd have a shot, and whoever the lowest score had to buy the shot. That's pretty funny.
Yep. There you go.
Mubs, do you want to hear a vegan story?
Sure. Let's hear a vegan story. I have nothing against vegans.
No, none of us do. But it makes stories like, you know, it's worth kind of getting back on. So there's all these misconceptions. Obviously, this is a whole thing about veganism. So this one woman from Australia said, the misconception that vegans are malnourished, I'm going to disprove it. I'm going to climb the 7 tallest peaks in the world.
Yeah.
On the weekend, she died in Everest.
Yeah.
Oi.
She
and
died of altitude sickness.
Yeah.
And so her quest is now finished.
She's actually South African born, that woman, but she was living in Australia.
Maria's Toledom. That would kind of make sense. Yeah, so she wanted to kind of prove that vegans could do anything, but she died of high altitude pulmonary edema.
Okay, but I mean,
anyone could die
from that because, you know, climbing a mountain that high, I mean, I know it's a great accomplishment and a feat if you do get to do it, but I don't know that it's recommended because of the effects that being at such a high altitude has on your body. And if, you know, if you're not like an athlete or whatever,
But even then, like, that's the weird thing about altitude sickness, that some people can be in terrible shape, not that great, and they can be fine. Other people, you just don't know.
Yes.
You know, it's even less scientific than Michael's drinking tolerance, which is always up for debate. Like, you literally can go up there, fit as a fiddle, or whatever you may be. So she was looking to strike a positive blow for the whole vegan cause, but now she's died. Obviously, the anti-vegan people are going to jump on this and go, well, I told you so.
Yeah. Mm.
If she had a burger halfway up, she would be fine.
Yeah.
But that's not the case, though. Anyone can die of what she just died of.
Just don't tempt fate. Be a, you know... Sometimes you just have to be a couch warrior. It's fine.
Couch warrior. I like that.
It's fine.
Yeah, okay. This whole thing of climbing Everest, people have been doing forever. Trust me, it's no big thing. Stay at home.
I just wonder how many unrecovered bodies are on that mountain, because surely they don't...
No, don't say that.
No, but I mean, it's a fact. Not all of the bodies are found of people who die on Mount Everest. Not all of them.
Yeah, I heard it's terrible once you get the top there, because obviously it's snow and it's cold, right?
Yeah.
Nothing kind of decomposes or anything. So you get up there, and you're dodging Bondi cigars. It's just horrible. It's messy.
It would be really cool if something was at the top, like a message or a secret
or a Yeti
or something like hectic.
That, a Yeti.
That was like the Everest secret. And if you go to the top and you get to read this or see it, you don't tell nobody. And only those that have been to Everest know. And then it makes you want to go there. And then people will get in shape and try and climb Everest.
Do you remember there was that story last year?
Or you find Elvis at the top there, strumming a banjo.
Do you remember there was that story last year about how there's just too much human feces on Mount Everest? Because,
yeah.
I mean, what do you do when you get up there? Yeah. Because I get how you have the base camps, but then once you start climbing, what do you do when you need to, you know,
and when
Mother Nature calls?
Does none of this decompose because of the cold climate?
No, it's frozen.
It freezes and it
so
accumulates.
You guys not hear me just talking about Bondi cigars like a minute ago?
Yes.
So the rocks, the rocks on Everest are actually giant piles of shit.
Possibly. Possibly.
Dodging boulders of crap.
But just think, you could have like 100-year-old famous poo up there.
You could.
Or you could just have poo. I'm guessing you just have poo up there. But like, how cool. It's like, oh, it's the best moment of my life. Oh, what have I stood in? What have I? Your
definition of cool is clearly different to mine.
No, I'm saying people climb Everest as a life-defining thing, right? Only so they can go stand in some turds.
Why aren't scientists going to Everest and collecting this poo? Because ancient poo, doesn't it hold secrets and stuff?
Secrets too.
Can't they analyze like what they were eating in the ancient times?
Well, if you just ask them, they'll tell you what they ate. Or, you know, there's logs around this. Sorry, wrong word. There's journals around this.
And I think there's hidden history in the poo on Everest.
Sorry, I'm still sort of stuck on this. So a corpse does not decompose. It makes sense because, like, in a morgue, it's kept in like
on
a
ice.
Fridge.
You keep someone on ice. Yeah.
So they are still looking pristine, and well, unless they were like smashed by a rock in the face.
Well, look, unless the Yetis eat them, who knows?
Yeah, that's true.
That also happens.
Yeah, there might be an animal that stumbles on a corpse.
I mean, the whole Nepalese Yeti society, they're very, very hardworking.
Hold up. I just had a bit of a little side thought. So if I am traveling with a group up Everest and I happen to die, and it's like too high for medics to reach or anything, does my group have to carry my dead body back down?
Yeah, that's why you got to pick your group. Sense. That's why you got to pick a group very, very wisely.
Oh, you guys are never. No thanks.
I just looked into what happens to the body on Everest. What it looks like, and I'm looking at a couple of dead bodies. It looks like it mummifies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what happens.
Changes color and sort of. It looks like something's wrapped around it.
Yeah, okay. Well, guys, before we get too lavatorial with how people die and poo and stuff, just quickly get the message before we get into the 8 hour. So, Jared was saying the percentage of alcohol does not vary, Flex. It's people's tolerance that varies. So I think he's agreeing with you on that one. And then talking about the toilets, Ankia says, I just have unisex everything, unisex toilets. So no urinals whatsoever, closed toilets, everyone pees together. To which Ndumi says, that's exactly how we go at home. So what's the big deal about a unisex toilet? That's what we all have at home.
Yeah, we all share the same toilet.
No, I'm against that. I like a urinal. The fact that I don't
have... Do you have a urinal at home?
No, I wish. That's like the ultimate luxury at home.
Yeah, it's actually true.
I went to one person's house, they had a urinal. I think I even Instagrammed a photo of it.
Yeah, that's cool. Like, you know, who wants a bidet? You want a urinal, that's what you want at home. Cindy says, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Grosse Michel still alive? If so, that's why all the properties aren't being distributed, especially if they're a married in community of property.
She's still alive. She's rolling in all of that property. She's very much alive.
So Sia, impersonating a grandchild of the Mandelas this year to go to Mozambique is a good plan. But you're just a little bit flawed. And then Tembiani says, Ben, I want Cliff Central growth to translate into more people listening to the 6 to 6 shows. How are we supposed to keep up with 24-hour Cliff Central? Unfair, comrade. Too much content. We still have to work and make money for our kids. Yeah, it's a fair point.
Well, maybe this is why then podcasts are such a luxury, because then you can structure your time, or you can structure your listening according to your time, you know?
That's exactly what it is. Tembiani, we just want to create a box of chocolates, basically, as far as Gump said, and how you go about it's your own way.
I've got more messages here. Moira Magina on Twitter says there are over 200 bodies on Everest and they're used as landmarks. I don't know about that.
Landmarks.
And then Kelly says that we should all watch the movie Everest, insightful and terrifying. So, yeah. Help yourself.
Yeah, so... So it's like, okay, well, you're almost there if you go past the dead vegan. I mean, is that what they're basically saying?
I don't know.
Anyway, let's get it. We've got the interview coming up. We've got more news. And we've got conspiracy theory follow-on from yesterday. We actually got some people who are very interested in Michael's aliens and pyramids kind of thing. So we'll catch you back after this. CliffCentral.com.